The 33 sermons on Nibbana were delivered by the Venerable Bhikkhu Katukurunde Nyanananda in Sinhala at Mitrigala Nisaranavanaya Forest Hermitage. They were translated into English by the same Venerable Monk, presently residing at Potkulkala Forest Hermitage in Kandagedra Devalagam.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Etang santang etang panitang yadidang sabba sankhara samatho sabbo patipati nissaggo tannakkhayo virago nirodho nibbana. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the most venerable great preceptor and the assembly of the venerable meditative monks, this is the 13th sermon in the series of sermons on Nibbana. In our last sermon, we attempted an exposition under the topic Sabba Dhamma Mula Pariyaya, the basic pattern of behavior of all mind objects, which constitutes the theme of the very first sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, namely the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. We happened to mention that the discourse describes three different attitudes regarding 24 concepts such as earth, water, fire and air. We could, however, discuss only two of them the other day, namely the worldview or the attitude of the untaught ordinary person and the attitude of the noble one who is in higher training. So today, to begin with, let us bring up the third type of attitude given in the discourse, that is, the attitude of Arahants and that of the Tathagata, both being similar. It is described in these words: Patavim patavito abhijanati, patavim patavito abhinyaya, patavim namanyati, patavya namanyati, patavito namanyati, patavim metin namanyati, patavim nabhinandati, tanki sahetu parinyatang tasati vadami. The Arahant, as well as the Tathagata, understands through higher knowledge earth as earth. Having understood through higher knowledge earth as earth, he does not imagine earth to be earth. He does not imagine on the earth. He does not imagine from the earth. He does not imagine earth is mine. He does not delight in earth. Why is that? I say it is because it has been well comprehended by him. Let us now try to compare and contrast these three attitudes so that we can understand them in greater detail. The attitude of the untaught ordinary person in regard to any of the 24 concepts like earth, water, fire, air, the 24 cited being illustrations, is so oriented that he perceives it as such. For instance, in the case of earth, he perceives a real earth, that is, takes it as earth per se. It may sometimes be only a block of ice, but because it is hard to the touch, he grasps it as earth. Thus the ordinary person, the worldling, relies only on perception in his pursuit of knowledge. Having perceived earth as earth, he imagines it to be earth. The peculiarity of manyana or me thinking is that it is an imagining in terms of I and mine. So he first imagines it as earth, then he imagines on the earth, from the earth is mine, and delights in the earth. Here we find various flexional forms known to grammar. As a matter of fact, grammar itself is a product of the worldlings for purposes of transaction in ideas bound up with defilements. Its purpose is to enable beings who are overcome by the personality view to communicate with their like-minded fellow beings. Grammar, therefore, is something that caters to their needs. As such, it embodies certain misconceptions, some of which have been highlighted in this context. For instance, Pathaving Manyati could be interpreted as an attempt to imagine an earth as a full-fledged noun or substantive. It is conceived as something substantial. By Pathaviya Manyati, he imagines in the earth, the locative case is implied. While Pathaving Meti Manyati, he imagines earth is mine, is an instance of the genitive case expressing the idea of possession. Due to such imaginings, a reality is attributed to the concept of earth and its existence is taken for granted. In other words, these various forms of imaginings go to confirm the notion already aroused by the concept of earth. Once it is confirmed, one can delight in it, Pathaving Abhinandati. This then is the worldview of the untaught ordinary person. The other day we mentioned that the monk who is in higher training understands through higher knowledge, not through perception, earth as earth. Though it is a higher level of understanding, he is not totally free from imaginings. That is why certain peculiar expressions are used in connection with him, such as Pathaving Mamanyi, Pathaviya Mamanyi, Pathavito Mamanyi, Pathaving Meti Mamanyi, Pathaving Mabhinandi. Here we had to call in question the commentarial explanation. According to the commentary, this peculiar expression had to be used as a dilly-dally phrase because the monk in higher training could not be said to imagine or not imagine. But it is clear enough that the particle ma in this context is used in its prohibitive sense. Ma mani means do not imagine and ma abhinandi means do not delight. What is significant about the seka, the monk in higher training, is that he is in a stage of voluntary training. In fact, the word seka literally means a learner. That is to say, he has obtained a certain degree of higher understanding, but has not attained as yet full comprehension. It is precisely for that reason that the section about him is summed up by the statement, Tankisahetu parinyatang tassati, parinyayang tassati vadami. Why is that? Because I say that it should be comprehended by him. Since he has yet to comprehend it, he is following that course of higher training. The particle ma is therefore a pointer to that effect. For example, ma manyi, do not imagine, ma abhinandi, do not delight. In other words, the monk in higher training cannot help using the grammatical structure in usage among the worldlings. And as his latencies are not extinct as yet, he has to practice a certain amount of restraint. By constant employment of mindfulness and wisdom, he makes an attempt to be immune to the influence of the worldling's grammatical structure. There is a possibility that he would be carried away by the implications of such concepts as earth, water, fire and air in his communications with the world regarding them. So he strives to proceed towards full comprehension with the help of the higher understanding already won, keeping mindfulness and wisdom before him. That is the voluntary training implied here. The monk in higher training is called attagutto, in the sense that he tries to guard himself. Such phrases like mamanyi indicate that voluntary training in guarding himself. Here we had to add something more to the commentarial explanation. So this is the situation with the monk in higher training. Now, as to the Arahant and the Tathagata, the worldview of both are essentially the same. That is to say, they both have a higher knowledge as well as a full comprehension with regard to the concept of earth, for instance. Parinyatang tassati vadami. I say it has been comprehended by him. As such, they are not carried away by the implications of the worldling's grammatical structure. They make use of the worldly usage much in the same way as parents do when they are speaking in their child's language. They are not swept away by it. There is no inner entanglement in the form of imagining. There is no attachment, entanglement, and involvement by way of craving, conceit, and view in regard to those concepts. All this goes to show the immense importance of the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. One can understand why this sutta came to be counted as the first among the suttas of the Majjhima Nikaya. It is as if this sutta was intended to serve as the alphabet in deciphering the words used by the Buddha in his sermons delivered in discursive style. As a matter of fact, the Majjhima Nikaya in particular is a text abounding in deep suttas. This way we can understand why both higher knowledge and full comprehension are essential. We have shown above that this discourse bears some relation to the grammatical structure. Probably due to a lack of recognition of this relationship between the modes of imagining and the grammatical structure, the commentators were confronted with the problem while commenting upon this discourse. Such phrases as Pathavi Manyati and Pathavi Amanyati occur all over this discourse in referring to various ways of imagining. The commentator, however, always makes it a point to interpret these ways of imagining with reference to craving, conceit, and views. So when he comes to the phrase Ma Abhinandi, he finds it to be superfluous. That is why Venerable Buddha Gosa treats it as a repetition and poses a possible question as follows. Pathaving manyatiti eteneva etasmin atthe siddhe kasma evang uttanti che avicharitametang poranehi ayang paname attanomati desana vilasatova adinava dasanatova. Now this is how the commentator poses his own problem. When the phrase Pathaving manyati by itself fulfills the purpose, why is it that an additional phrase like Pathaving abhinandati is brought in? That is to say, if the imagining already implies craving, conceit, and views, what is the justification for the concluding phrase, Pathaving Abhinandati, he delights in earth, since craving already implies a form of delighting? So he takes it as a repetition and seeks for a justification. He confesses that the ancients have not handed down an explanation and offers his own personal opinion on it. Ayam paname attanomati. But then this is my own opinion. And what does his own explanation amount to? Desana vilasatova adinava dasanatova. Either as a particular style in preaching or by way of showing the perils of the ways of imagining. He treats it as yet another way of preaching peculiar to the Buddha, or else as an attempt to emphasize the perils of imagining. However, going by the explanation we have already given above, relating these modes of imagining to the structure of grammar, we can come to a conclusion as to why the phrase Ma Abhinandi was brought in. The reason is that each of those concepts crystallized into a real thing as a result of imagining, based on the framework of grammar. It received real object status in the world of imagination. Once its object status got confirmed, one can certainly delight in it. It became a thing in truth and fact. The purpose of these ways of imagining is to mold it into a thing. Let us go deeper into this problem. There is, for instance, a certain recurrent passage in the discourses on the subject of sense restraint. The gist of that passage amounts to this. A person with defilements takes in signs and features through all the six sense doors, inclusive of the mind. Due to that grasping at signs and features, various kinds of influxes are said to flow in, according to the passages outlining the practice of sense restraint. From this, we can well infer that the role of manjana or imagining is to grasp at signs with regard to the objects of the mind. That is to say, the mind perceives its object as something, dhamma sanya. The word dhamma in the opening sentence of this sutta, sabba dhamma mula pariyayam bo bhikkave dese sami, means a thing, since everything is an object of the mind, in the last analysis. Patavim manyati, he imagines earth as earth, is suggestive of a grasping at a sign in regard to objects of the mind. Thinking in such terms as pataviya manyati, patavito manyati, and pataving meti manyati, he imagines on the earth, he imagines from the earth, he imagines earth is mind, are like the corroborative features that go to confirm that sign already grasped. The two terms nimitta, sign, and anubhyanjana, feature, in the context of sense restraint, have to be understood in this way. Now, the purpose of a nimitta or sign is to give a hazy idea like this may be so. It receives confirmation with the help of corroborative features, anubhyanjana, or the features that are accessory to the sign. The corroboration comes, for instance, in this manner. This goes well with this. This accords with this. Therefore, the sign I took is right. So even on the basis of instructions on sense restraint, we can understand the special significance of this manjana or me-thinking. The reason for the occurrence of these different ways of me-thinking can also be understood. In this discourse, the Buddha is presenting a certain philosophy of the grammatical structure. The structure of grammar is a contrivance for conducting the worldling's thought process, characterized by the perception of permanence, as well as for communication of ideas arising out of that process. The grammatical structure invests words with life, as it were. This mode of hypostasizing is revealed in the nouns and substantives implying such notions as in it, by it, and from it. The last of the flexional forms, the vocative case, he patavi, he earth, effectively illustrates this hypostasizing character of grammar. It is even capable of infusing life into the concept of earth and arousing it with the words he earth. In an earlier sermon, we had occasion to refer to a legend in which a tiger was reconstituted and resurrected out of its skeletal remains. The structure of grammar seems to be capable of a similar feat. Mula Pariyaya Sutta gives us an illustration of this fact. It is because of the obsessional character of this manjana or me-thinking that the Buddha has presented this Mula Pariyaya Sutta to the world as the basic pattern or paradigm representing three types of worldview, or the worldview of three types of persons. This discourse deals with the untaught, ordinary person who is obsessed by this grammatical structure, the disciple in higher training who is trying to free himself from its grip, and the emancipated one completely free from it, at the same time giving their respective worldviews as well. The other day, we enumerated the list of 24 concepts presented in that discourse. Out of these concepts, we have to pay special attention to the fact that Nibbana is counted as the last, since it happens to be the theme of all our sermons. Regarding this concept of Nibbana too, the worldling is generally tempted to entertain some kind of manjana or me-thinking. Even some philosophers are prone to that habit. They indulge in some sort of prolific conceptualization and me-thinking on the basis of such conventional usages as in Nibbana, from Nibbana, on reaching Nibbana, and my Nibbana. By hypostasizing Nibbana, they develop a substance view even of this concept, just as in the case of patavi or earth. Let us now try to determine whether this is justifiable. The primary sense of the word Nibbana is extinction or extinguishment. We have already discussed this point with reference to such contexts as Aggivacchagotta Sutta. In that discourse, the Buddha explained the term Nibbana to the wandering ascetic Vacchagotta with the help of a simile of an extinction of a fire. Simply because a fire is said to go out, one should not try to trace it, wondering where it has gone. The term Nibbana is essentially a verbal noun. We also came across the phrase Nibbutoti Sankham Gacchati. It is reckoned as extinguished. As we have already pointed out in a previous sermon, Sankha, Samanya and Panyati, reckoning, appellation and designation are more or less synonymous. Sankham Gacchati only means comes to be reckoned. Nibbana is therefore some sort of reckoning, an appellation or designation. The word Nibbana, according to the Aggivacchagotta Sutta, is a designation or concept. But the commentator takes much pains to prove that Nibbana, mentioned at the end of the list in the Mulapariyaya Sutta, refers not to our orthodox Nibbana, but to a concept of Nibbana upheld by heretics. The commentator, it seems, is at pains to salvage our Nibbana, but his attempt is at odds with the trend of this discourse, because the sekha or the monk in higher training has no need to train himself in refraining from delighting in any heretical Nibbana. So here too the reference is to our orthodox Nibbana. Presumably the commentator could not understand why the Arahants do not delight in Nibbana. For instance, in the section on the Tathagata, one reads Nibbanam na abhinandati tankissa hetu nandi dukkhasa mulanti iti viditva bhava jati bhutasya jara maranam. He does not delight in Nibbana. Why so? Because he knows that delighting is the root of suffering, and from becoming comes birth, and to the one become there is decay and death. It seems then that the Tathagata does not delight in Nibbana because delighting is the root of suffering. Now Nandi is a form of grasping, upadana, impelled by craving. It is sometimes expressly called an upadana. Yavedanasu Nandi tadupadana. What we are delighting there is in feelings, that is a grasping. Where there is delighting, there is a grasping. Where there is grasping, there is bhava, becoming or existence. From becoming comes birth. And to the one who has thus come to be, there is decay and death. It is true that we project the concept of Nibbana as an objective to aim at in our training. But if we grasp it like the concept of earth and start indulging in me-thinkings or imaginings about it, we would never be able to realize it. Why? Because what we have here is an extraordinary path leading to an emancipation from all concepts. Nisaya Nisaya Oghasa Nitharana, crossing over the flood with relative dependence. Whatever is necessary is made use of, but there is no grasping in terms of craving, conceits and views. That is why even with reference to the Tathagata, the phrase Nibbanam na abhinandati, he does not delight in Nibbana, occurs in this discourse. One might ask, what is wrong in delighting in Nibbana? But then we might recall a pithy dialogue already quoted in an earlier sermon. A deity comes and accosts the Buddha. Do you rejoice, recluse? And the Buddha responds, on getting what, friend? Then the deity asks, well then, recluse, do you grieve? And the Buddha retorts, on losing what, friend? The deity now mildly remarks, so then the recluse, you neither rejoice nor grieve. And the Buddha confirms it with the assent, that is so, friend. This then is the attitude of the Buddhas and Arahants to the concept of Nibbana. There is nothing to delight in it, only equanimity is there. Seen in this perspective, the word Nibbana mentioned in the Mulapariyaya Sutta need not be taken as referring to a concept of Nibbana current among heretics. The reference here is to our own orthodox Nibbana concept. But the attitude towards it must surely be changed in the course of treading the path to it. If on the contrary, one grasps it tenaciously and takes it to be substantial, presuming that the word is a full-fledged noun, and goes on to argue it out on the basis of logic and proliferate on it conceptually, it will no longer be our Nibbana. There one slips into wrong view. One would never be able to extricate oneself from wrong view that way. Here then is an issue of crucial importance. Many philosophers start their exposition with an implicit acceptance of conditionality. But when they come to the subject of Nibbana, they have recourse to some kind of instrumentality. On reaching Nibbana, lust and the like are abandoned. Commentators resort to such explanations under the influence of Manjana. They seem to imply that Nibbana is instrumental in quenching the fires of defilement. To say that fires of defilement are quenched by Nibbana or on arriving at it is to get involved in a circular argument. It is itself an outcome of papancha or conceptual prolificity and betrays an enslavement to the syntax. When one says the river flows, it does not mean that there is a river quite apart from the act of flowing. Likewise, the idiom "it rains" should not be taken to imply that there is something that rains. It is only a turn of speech fulfilling a certain requirement of the grammatical structure. On an earlier occasion, we happened to discuss some very important aspects of the Pottapada Sutta. We saw how the Buddha presented the philosophy of language, which seems so extraordinary even to modern thinkers. This Moolapariyaya Sutta also brings out a similar attitude to the linguistic medium. Such elements of a language as nouns and verbs reflect the worldling's mode of thinking. As in the case of a child's imagination, a noun appears as a must. So it has to rain for there to be rain. The implicit verbal sense becomes obscured, or else it is ignored. A periphrastic usage receives acceptance. So the rain rains and the river flows. A natural phenomenon becomes mystified and hypostasized. Anthropomorphism is a characteristic of the prehistoric man's philosophy of life. Wherever there was an activity, he imagined some form of life. This animistic trend of thought is evident even in the relation between the noun and the verb. The noun has adjectives as attributes, and the verb has adverbs to go with it. Particles fall in between, and there we have what is called the grammar. If one imagines that the grammar of language must necessarily conform to the grammar of nature, one falls into a grievous error. Now the commentators also seem to have fallen into such an error in their elaborate exegesis on Nibbana due to a lack of understanding of this philosophy of language. That is why the Moolapariyaya Sutta now finds itself relegated, though it is at the head of the suttas of the Majjhima Nikaya. It is in the nature of concepts that nouns are invested with a certain amount of permanence. Even a verbal noun, once it is formed, gets a degree of permanence more or less superimposed on it. When one says the river flows, one somehow tends to forget the fluctuational nature of the so-called river. This is the result of the perception of permanence. As a matter of fact, perception as such carries with it the notion of permanence, as we mentioned in an earlier sermon. To perceive is to grasp a sign. One can grasp a sign only where one imagines some degree of permanence. The purpose of perception is not only to recognize for oneself, but also to make it known to others. The Buddha has pointed out that there is a very close relationship between recognition and communication. This fact is expressly stated by the Buddha in the following quotation from the sixes of the Anguttara Nikaya. Ohara vepakkaham bhikkave sanyam vadami yatha yathanam sanjanati tatha tatha voharati evam sanyi ahosinti. Monks, I say that perception has linguistic usage as its result. In whatever way one perceives, so one speaks out about it, saying, "I was of such a perception." The word vepakka is a derivative from the word vipaka, which in the context of karma or ethically significant action generally means the result of that action. In this context, however, its primary sense is evident, that is, as some sort of ripening. In other words, what this quotation implies is that perception ripens or matures into verbal usage or convention. So here we see the connection between sanya, perception, and sankha, reckoning. This throws more light on our earlier explanation of the last line of a verse in Kalahavivada Sutta, namely sanya nidanahi papancha sankha, for reckonings born of prolificity have perception as their source. So now we are in a better position to appreciate the statement that linguistic usages, reckonings, and designations are the outcome of perception. All this goes to show that an insight into the philosophy of language is essential for a proper understanding of this dhamma. This is the moral behind the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. Beings are usually dominated by these reckonings, appellations, and designations because the perception of permanence is inherent in them. It is extremely difficult for one to escape it. Once the set of such terms as milk, curd, and butter comes into vogue, the relation between them becomes an insoluble problem even for the great philosopher. Since we have been talking about the concept of Nibbana so much, one might ask, so then Nibbana is not an absolute, paramattha. It is not a paramattha in the sense of an absolute. It is a paramattha only in the sense that it is the highest good, paramattha. This is the sense in which the word was used in the discourses, though it has different connotations now. As exemplified by such quotations as Aradha Viryo Paramattha Pattiya, its steadfast energy for the attainment of the highest good, the suttas speak of Nibbana as the highest good to be attained. In later Buddhist thought, however, the word paramattha came to acquire absolutist connotations, due to which some important discourses of the Buddha on the question of worldly appellations, worldly expressions, and worldly designations fell into disuse. This led to an attitude of dwelling in the scaffolding improvised just for the purpose of constructing a building. As a postscript to our exposition of the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, we may add the following important note. This particular discourse is distinguished from all other discourses in respect of one significant feature, that is, the concluding statement to the effect that the monks who listened to the sermon were not pleased by it. Generally, we find at the end of a discourse a more or less thematic sentence like, Attamanate bhikkhu bhagavato bhasitam abhinandum. Those monks were pleased and they rejoiced in the words of the Exalted One. But in this sutta we find the peculiar ending, Idamavacha bhagava nate bhikkhu bhagavato bhasitam abhinandum. The Exalted One said this, but those monks did not rejoice in the words of the Exalted One. Commentators seem to have interpreted this attitude as an index to the abstruseness of the discourse. This is probably why this discourse came to be neglected in course of time. But on the basis of the exposition we have attempted, we might advance a different interpretation of the attitude of those monks. A declaration that none of the concepts, including that of Nibbana, should be egoistically imagined, could have caused displeasure in monks then as now. So much then for the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. The Buddha has pointed out that this manyana or egoistic imagining or me thinking is an extremely subtle bond of mara. A discourse which highlights this fact comes in the Samyutta Nikaya under the title Yavakalapi Sutta. In this discourse, the Buddha brings out this fact with the help of a parable. It concerns the battle between gods and demons, which is a theme that comes up quite often in the discourses. In a war between gods and demons, gods are victorious and demons are defeated. Gods bind Vyapachitti, the king of demons, in a fivefold bondage, that is, hands and feet, and neck and bring him before Sakka, the king of gods. This bondage has a strange mechanism about it. When Vepachitti thinks gods are righteous, demons are unrighteous, I will go to the Dev world, he immediately finds himself free from that bondage and capable of enjoying the heavenly pleasures of the five senses. But as soon as he slips into the thought, gods are unrighteous, demons are righteous, I will go back to the Asura world, he finds himself divested of the heavenly pleasures and bound again by the fivefold bonds. After introducing this parable, the Buddha comes out with a deep disquisition of Dhamma, for which it serves as a simile. Evaṃ sukhamaṃ kho vepacitti bandhanaṃ tato sukhamataraṃ māra bandhanaṃ manyamāno kho bhikkave baddho mārasa amanyamāno mutto pāpimato asmīti bhikkave manyitametaṃ ayamaham asmīti manyitametaṃ bhavissanti manyitametaṃ na bhavissanti manyitametaṃ rūpī bhavissanti manyitametaṃ arūpī bhavissanti manyitametaṃ sanyī bhavissanti manyitametaṃ asanyī bhavissanti manyitametaṃ මේ සංඥේ නා සංඥේ භවිසන්ති මඤ්ඤිතමේතං මඤ්ඤිතං භික්ඛවේ රෝගෝ මඤ්ඤිතං ගණ්ඩෝ මඤ්ඤිතං සල්ලං සස්මාතිය භික්ඛවේ අමඤ්ඤමාණේන චේතසා විහෙරිසාමාති ඒවං හිබෝ භික්ඛවේ සික්ඛිතබ්බං. So subtle monks is the bondage of vipacitti, but more subtle still the bondage of mara. Imagining monks, one is bound by mara, not imagining, one is freed from the evil one. M monks is an imagining, this am I is an imagining, I shall be is an imagining, I shall not be is an imagining, I shall be one with form is an imagining, I shall be formless is an imagining, I shall be percipient is an imagining, I shall be non-percipient is an imagining, I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is an imagining. Imagining monks is a disease. Imagining is an abscess. Imagining is a barb. Therefore, monks, should you tell yourself, we shall dwell with the mind free from imaginings. Thus should you train yourselves. First of all, let us try to get at the meaning of this exhortation. The opening sentence is an allusion to the simile given above. It says that the bondage in which Vepacitti finds himself is of a subtle nature. That is to say, it is a bondage connected with his thoughts. Its very mechanism is dependent on his thoughts. But then the Buddha declares that the bondage of Mara is even subtler. And what is that? This bondage of Mara? Imagining monks, one is bound by Mara. Not imagining, one is freed from that evil one. Then comes the list of 9 different ways of imagining. In the same discourse, the Buddha goes on to qualify each of these imaginings with 4 significant terms, namely, injitaṃ, agitation, panditaṃ, palpitation, papanchitaṃ, proliferation, and managataṃ, conceit. Injitaṃ is an indication that these forms of imaginings are the outcome of craving, since eja is a synonym for tanha or craving. Panditaṃ is an allusion to the fickleness of the mind, as for instance conveyed by the first line of a verse in the Dhammapada, Pandanam Chapalam Chitta, the mind palpitating and fickle. The fickle nature of the mind brings out those imaginings. They are also the products of proliferation, papanchita. We have already discussed the meaning of the term papancha. We happen to point out that it is a sort of straying away from the proper path. Managataṃ is suggestive of a measuring. Asmi or am is the most elementary standard of measurement. It is the peg from which all measurements take their direction. As we pointed out in an earlier sermon, the grammatical structure of a language is based on this peg am. In connection with the 3 persons, first person, second person and third persons, we happen to mention that as soon as one plants I am, a here is born. It is only after a here is born that a there and a yonder come to be. The first person gives rise to a second and a third person to complete the basic framework for grammar. So asmi-om is itself a product of proliferation. In fact, the deviation from the proper path implied by the proliferation in papancha is a result of these multifarious imaginings. It is in the nature of these imaginings that as soon as an imagining or me thinking occurs, a thing is born as a matter of course. And with the birth of a thing as something, impermanence takes over. That is to say, it comes under the sway of impermanence. This is a very strange phenomenon. It is only after becoming a something that it can become another thing. Anyatha bhava or otherwiseness implies a change from one state to another. A change of state already presupposes some state or other, and that is what is called a thing. Now where does a thing arise? It arises in the mind. As soon as something gets hold of the mind, that thing gets infected with the germ of impermanence. The modes of imagining listed above reveal a double bind. There is no freedom either way. Whether one imagines, I shall be with form or I shall be formless, one is in a dichotomy. It is the same with the two ways of imagining. I shall be percipient, I shall be non-percipient. We had occasion to refer to this kind of dichotomy while explaining the significance of quite a number of discourses. The root of all this duality is the thought am. The following two verses from the Dvaitanupassana Sutta throws light on some subtle aspects of manyana or imagining. Yena yena hi manyanti tato tang hoti anyatha tang hitasya musa hoti mosa dhammangi ittarang amosa dhammang nibbanang tadariya sachato vidum teve sachabhisamaya nichhata parinibbuta. In whatever way they imagine, thereby it turns otherwise. That itself is the falsity of this puerile, deceptive thing. Nibbana is unfalsifying in its nature. That they understood as the truth, and indeed, by the higher understanding of that truth, they have become hungerless and fully appeased. The first verse makes it clear that imagining is at the root of anyata bhava or otherwiseness, insofar as it creates a thing out of nothing. As soon as a thing is conceived in the mind by imagining, the germ of otherwiseness or change enters into it at its very conception. So a thing is born only to become another thing due to the otherwiseness in nature. To grasp a thing tenaciously is to exist with it, and birth, decay and death are the inexorable vicissitudes that go with it. The second verse says that Nibbana is known as the truth because it is of an unfalsifying nature. Those who have understood it are free from the hunger of craving. The word parinibbuta in this context does not mean that those who have realized that truth have passed away. It only conveys the idea of full appeasement or quenching of that hunger. Why is Nibbana regarded as unfalsifying? Because there is no thing in it. It is so long as there is a thing that all the distress and misery follow. Nibbana is called animitta or the signless precisely because there is nothing in it. Because it is signless, it is unestablished, appanihita. Only where there is an establishment can there be a dislodgement. Since it is not liable to dislodgement or disintegration, it is unshakable. It is called akuppa cheto vimutti, unshakable deliverance of the mind, because of its unshaken and stable nature. Due to the absence of craving, there is no establishment or panidhi. Similarly, sunyata or wideness is a term implying that there is no essence in Nibbana. In the substantial sense, the worldlings use that term. As mentioned in the Mahasaropama Sutta, deliverance itself is the essence. Apart from that, there is nothing essential or substantial in Nibbana. In short, there is no thing to become otherwise in Nibbana. On an earlier occasion too, we had to mention the fact that there is quite a lot of confusion in this concern. Sankhata, the compounded, is supposed to be a thing, and asankhata, or the uncompounded, is also a thing. The compounded is an impermanent thing, while the uncompounded is a permanent thing. The compounded is fraught with suffering, and the uncompounded is blissful. The compounded is not self, but the uncompounded is. At this point, the line of argument breaks off. Some of those who attempt this kind of explanation find themselves in a quandary due to their lack of understanding of the issues involved. The two verses quoted above are therefore highly significant. Because of manyana, worldlings tend to grasp, hold on, and adhere to mind objects. The Buddha has presented these concepts just for the purpose of crossing over the flood. Desita nissaya nissaya oghasa nittharana. The process of crossing over the flood with relative dependence has been preached. All the dhammas that have been preached are for a practical purpose based on an understanding of their relative value and not for grasping tenaciously, as illustrated by such discourses like Rathavinita and Aludhadhyupamsutta. Let alone other concepts, not even Nibbana as a concept is to be grasped. To grasp the concept of Nibbana is to slip into an error. So from the couplet quoted above, we clearly understand how subtle this manyana is and why it is called an extremely subtle bondage of mind. It might be recalled that while discussing the significance of the Brahman Nimantanika Sutta, we mentioned that the non-manifestative consciousness described in that discourse does not partake of the earthiness of earth. That is to say, it is not under the sway of the earth quality of earth. In fact, as many as 13 out of the 24 concepts mentioned in the Mulapariyaya Sutta came up again in the Brahmanimantanika Sutta. The implication, therefore, is that the non-manifestative consciousness is not subject to the influence of any of those concepts. It does not take any of those concepts as substantial or essential, and that is why it is beyond their power. For the same reason, it is called the non-manifestative consciousness. Consciousness, as a rule, takes hold of some object or other. This consciousness, however, is called non-manifestative in the sense that it is devoid of the nature of grasping any such object. It finds no object worthy of grasping. What we have discussed so far could perhaps be better appreciated in the light of another important sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, namely the Chula Tanha Sankhaya Sutta. A key to the moral behind this discourse is to be found in the following dictum occurring in it. Sabbe Dhamma Nalang Abhinivesaya. Nothing is worth entering into dogmatically. The word abhinivesa is suggestive of dogmatic adherence. Literally means entering into. Now, based on this idea, we can bring in a relevant metaphor. We happened to mention earlier that as far as concepts are concerned, the Arahants have no dogmatic adherence. Let us take, for instance, the concept of a house. Arahants also enter a house, but they do not enter into the concept of a house. This statement might appear rather odd, but what we mean is that one can enter a house without entering into the concept of a house. Now, leaving this as something of a riddle, let us try to analyze a certain fairy tale-like episode in the Chula Tanha Sankhaya Sutta somewhat as an interlude. The main theme of the Chula Tanha Sankhaya Sutta is as follows. One Sakka, the king of gods, came to see the Buddha when he was staying at Pubbarama and asked the question, how does a monk attain deliverance by the complete destruction of craving? The quintessence of the Buddha's brief reply to that question is the above-mentioned dictum, Sabbe Dhamma Nalang Abhinivesaya. Nothing is worth entering into dogmatically. Sakya rejoiced in this sermon approvingly and left. Venerable Mahamoggallana, who was seated near the Buddha at that time, had the inquisitive thought, Did the Sakha rejoice in this sermon having understood it, or did he rejoice without understanding it? Being curious to find this out, he vanished from Pubbarama and appeared in Tavatinsa heaven as quickly as a strong man might stretch out his bent arm and bend back his outstretched arm. At that time, Sakha was enjoying heavenly music. On seeing Venerable Mahamoggallana coming in a distance, he stopped the music and welcomed the latter, saying, "Come, good sir Moggallana, welcome, good sir Moggallana. It is a long time, good sir Moggallana, since you found an opportunity to come here." He offered a high seat to Venerable Mahamoggallana and took a low seat at one side. Then Venerable Mahamoggallana asked Sakha what sort of a sermon the Buddha had preached to him on his recent visit, saying that he himself is curious on listening to it. The Sakha's reply was, "Good sir Moggallana, we are so busy. We have so much to do, not only with our own business, but also with the business of other gods of Tavatinsa. So it is not easy for us to remember such Dhamma discussions." Then Sakha goes on to relate some other episode, which to him seems more important. "After winning the war against Asuras, I had the Vaijayanti Palace built. Would you like to see it, good sir Moggallana?" Probably as a part of etiquette binding on a visitor, Venerable Mahamoggallana agreed, and Sakha conducted him around the Vaijayanti Palace in the company of his friend King Vesavana. It was a wonderful palace with hundreds of towers. Sakha's maids, seeing Venerable Mahamoggallana coming in the distance, were embarrassed out of modest respect and went into their rooms. And Sakha was taking Venerable Mahamoggallana around, saying, "See, good sir, how lovely this palace is." Venerable Mahamoggallana also courteously responded, saying that it is a fitting gift for his past merit. But then he thought of arousing a sense of urgency in Sakha, seeing how negligent he has become now. And what did he do? He shook the Vaijayanti Palace with the point of his toe, using his supernormal power. Since Sakha had entered into the Vaijayanti Palace with his craving, conceit and views, he also was thoroughly shaken along with the palace. That is to say, a sense of urgency was aroused in him. So much so that he remembered the sermon the Buddha had preached to him. It was then that Venerable Mahamoggallana asked Sakha pointedly, "How did the Exalted One state to you in brief deliverance through the destruction of craving?" Sakha came out with the full account creditably. So after all, it seems that the Venerable Mahamoggallana took all this trouble to drive home into Sakha the moral of the sermon, "Sabbe Dhamma Nalang Abhinivesaya," nothing is worth clinging on to. If one goes through this discourse ignoring the deeper aspects of it, it appears merely as a fairy tale. Even as those heavenly maids entered their rooms, Sakha also had entered into this Vaijayanti Palace of his own creation, while showing his distinguished visitor around, like a rich man these days after building his mansion. So from this, we can see the nature of these worldly concepts. For instance, in the case of the concept of a house, entering the house physically does not necessarily mean that one is in it. Only if one has entered into the concept of a house is he in it. Let us take a simple analogy. Little children sometimes build a little hut out of fun with a few sticks and shady leaves. They might even invite their mother for the housewarming. When the mother creeps into the improvised hut, she does not seriously entertain the concept of a house in it, as the children would do. It is the same in the case of Buddhas and Arahants. To the emancipated ones who have fully understood and comprehended the true meaning of concepts like house, mansion and palace, the sad castles of adults appear no better than the playthings of little children. We have to grant it, therefore, that Tathagatas or such like ones cannot help making use of concepts in worldly usage. As a matter of fact, once a certain deity even raised the question whether the emancipated Arahant monks when they use such expressions as I speak and they speak to me, do so out of conceit. The Buddha's reply was, Yohoti bhikkhu arahaṁ katāvi thena savo antima deha dhāri aham vadāmi iti piso vadeya mamam vadanti iti piso vadeya loke samanyam kusalo viditva vohara mattena so vo hareya. That monk who is an arahant, who has finished his task, whose influxes are extinct, and who bears his final body, might still say, I speak. He might also say, they speak to me. Being skillful, knowing the world's parlance, he uses such terms merely as a convention. In the case of an arahant, who has accomplished his task and is influx-free, a concept like house, mansion, or palace has no influence by way of craving, conceit, and views. He might say, I speak, or I preach. He might even say, they speak to me. But since he has understood the nature of worldly parlance, he uses such expressions as mere turns of speech. Therefore, the Buddhas and Arahants, though they may enter a house, do not entertain the concept of a house in it. Some might think that in order to destroy the concept of a house, one has to break up the tiles and bricks into atoms. But that is not the way to deliverance. One has to understand, according to the law of dependent arising, that not only is a house dependent on tiles and bricks, but the tiles and bricks are themselves dependent on a house. Very often philosophers forget about the principle of relativity involved here. Tiles and bricks are dependent on a house. This is a point worth considering. One might think that a house is made up of tiles and bricks, but tiles and bricks themselves come to be because of a house. There is a mutual relationship between them. If one raises the question, what is a tile? The answer will be, it is an item used for building the roof of a house. Likewise, a brick is an item used in building a wall. This shows the relativity between a house and a tile, as well as between a house and a brick. So there is no need to get down to an atomistic analysis like nuclear physicists. Wisdom is something that enables one to see this relativity penetratively, then and there. Today we happen to discuss some deep sections in the Dhamma, particularly on the subject of Manjana. A reappraisal of some of the deep suttas preached by the Buddha, now relegated into the background as those dealing with conventional truth, will be greatly helpful in dispelling the obsessions created by Manjana. What the Mula Pariyaya Sutta offers in this respect is of utmost importance. In fact, the Buddha never used a language totally different from the language of the worldlings. Now, for instance, chemists make use of a certain system of symbolic formulas in their laboratories, but back at home, they revert to another set of symbols. However, both are symbols. There is no need to discriminate between them as high or low, so long as they serve the purpose at hand. Therefore, it is not proper to relegate some sermons as discursive or conventional in style. Always, it is a case of using concepts in worldly parlance. In the laboratory, one uses a particular set of symbols, but on returning home, he uses another. In the same way, it is not possible to earmark a particular bundle of concepts as absolute and unchangeable. As stated in the Pottapada Sutta, already discussed, all these concepts are worldly appellations, worldly expressions, worldly usages, worldly designations, which the Tathagata makes use of without tenacious grasping. However philosophical or technical the terminology may be, the Arahants make use of it without grasping tenaciously. What is of importance is the function it fulfills. We should make use of the conceptual scaffolding only for the purpose of putting up the building. As the building comes up, the scaffolding has to leave. It has to be dismantled. If one simply clings on to the scaffolding, the building would never come up.
Dear listeners, it is our sincere wish to make these sermons accessible, free of charge, to all who like to listen to them, because the gift of the Dhamma excels all other gifts. We therefore encourage you to copy these sermons and share them with others, but kindly note that they should not be reproduced for sale. May the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you.